anytime I get into the ice bath, I don't want to. I've already been freezing in the military and all these different things, but every time I do, I'm overriding that limbic system that says, no, 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 you're not in charge. I'm in charge. I'm telling you that you're getting in there. The amount of exposure that you have in different disciplines like that allows you to override that part of your brain that wants to fight, and you can fight more.
Welcome to Mindful Warrior Radio, a podcast that explores the intersection of leadership, culture, performance, and flow. Through thought-provoking conversations with innovative changemakers and industry leaders, we uncover the mindsets, strategy, and experiences that drive personal and professional excellence. Each episode offers real-world insight, inspiring stories, and actionable wisdom to help you cultivate resilience, purpose, and peak performance in your own life. Today on Mindful Warrior Radio, we welcome Prime Hall, a former Marine Raider, entrepreneur, master trainer, and founder of Deep End Fitness and the Underwater Torpedo League. Prime has trained and empowered thousands, from service members in Iraq and Afghanistan to Olympic athletes, professional teams, and high-level executives. A human performance enthusiast, he has helped people unlock results, turn obstacles into opportunities, and access flow under pressure. Prime has also authored the book, Free Your Mind and Unlock Flow, sharing his journey from pain to purpose. He has also co-founded Operation Resilience, supporting veterans, special operation forces, and professional athletes with mental health, transition, and community resources. Prime's mission is to empower leaders at the top of their field to create a ripple effect of impact across the world. Let's dive in on today's episode of Mindful Warrior Radio. We have Prime Hall joining us today on Mindful Warrior Radio. It is such a privilege and a joy to have you on. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's good to see you again.
Likewise.
It's been a little while now.
It has been. I'm excited for our conversation. So I'm going to drop right in. You are a former Marine Raider, and you have had a career in the military. And I would imagine in the work that you are doing today, you're applying experience, knowledge, and wisdom that you have earned and gained in your military career alongside of your continued education and training. And you're applying all of that to the work that you're doing today. But I would imagine your military career really gave you a lot of gifts and tools and skill sets that you're using constantly today in the arenas that you're working in. And before we drop into what you are really providing, you know, to different industries and different arenas, I'm curious of what influenced your decision to enlist in the military and what kind of personal belief systems really guided that choice for you? What brought you into that lane that gave you all the gifts that you're using today?
Wow. Well, thank you for that. And I had an interesting journey that led me into the Marines. And I grew up in South Texas, in a place called Corpus Christi. And then my grandparents and my mom's family lived 2 hours south in South Padre Island, which is a big spring break spot and close to the border of Mexico. So that's where I grew up down there. And I was in a situation, my parents divorced after eighth grade. And my mom moved away and my dad moved out. And so I ended up living in an apartment by myself at a young age for like 3 or 4 years after eighth grade. Eighth grade summer into high school. And so my grandparents had came, I think, my sophomore year, after my sophomore year in the summer, and they realized that I was living by myself. They picked me up to take me on a vacation, and they saw that I was living by myself, and they were like, "This is unacceptable. You know, like you need security, you need stability, you need support." So, at that time, they offered to send me at the end of the summer to Marine Military Academy. And from my experience, like a lot of the kids, like 99% of the kids, they were sent there against their will. And so it's like, you know, when the day that the parents are dropping the kids off, you know, the kids are like, you know, still fighting to try to go back home. Whereas for me, I was volunteer. So my grandparents said, "Hey, we will pay the money and send you." It was like very expensive program. And we'll send you, and we want it to prep you for life. And so I went voluntarily, and that was like a different energy that I came with, because I was coming from no security, no rules, no stability, and being scared all the time when I was by myself in my house, to now having, you know, full security, rules, stability, and like a whole community of people that I was, you know, locked up in there with, right? And so that experience was really transformational for me. And my drill instructor became like my father figure that I had, and like a very big mentor and stuff like that. So after high school, when I was kind of looking at what I was going to do and how I was going to, you know, be able to like make something of my life, my grandparents kept going, pointing back to like, "Remember at military school, you did so well. What if we took you to the Marine office?" And so it got to a point to where I had gotten arrested. I was in trouble, and I was basically like, you know, there was the judge happened to be a friend of the family. And so my grandfather made a deal with the judge that he could get me into the Marines, and I will go that route instead of going to jail. And so it's basically like, you know, a lot of people sign up for different reasons, but my reasons were I wanted to make my grandparents proud because I felt like they saved me. And I wanted to obviously a get out of jail free card, which I got. So that was what kind of led me to the Marine Corps. So I came out here to California 20 years ago. My first 4 years, I was infantry, Marine, and machine gunner in the regular Marine Corps. And then after that, they started Marine Raiders, and I got to go in at the beginning or the forefront of Marine Special Operations in present day, as the unit was being formed. And so I had a pretty crazy experience in that, where it's kind of like a startup. That's where I think of it now. Like, you know, we were creating the share drive, we were creating the operating procedures, the rules, the operations, you know, everything that had to do with everything from the ground up. And so it was a wealth of experience, as you stated. It's a lot of mission planning tools that you get to plan missions, to plan deployments, to plan things where you're going from continental United States and now you're in Iraq or Afghanistan or in the jungle of the Philippines or whatever it is. And so there's systems and frameworks and tools that kind of get ingrained in you for mission planning and all of that. So a lot of that is plug and play. There was a big, post World War II, there was a big business boom, economic boom, because the military members came back with all of these mission planning tools, and they plugged it right into business, you know, even without a business degree or anything. So, you know, there's a lot there, but I think there's bigger lessons. There's hard skills and soft skills, and there's bigger lessons that I take away from it that I use every day. And one of those is operating without your rank. And so in the military, sometimes it becomes a trap where you get rank on your collar, and then you need someone of a lower rank to do something. And so, you know, in a pinch, you'll use your rank to order somebody to do something, right? And from my experience, that gets the least amount of respect and performance and teamwork and camaraderie than any other option. So for me, when I was in my first couple of years, I had the privilege of getting into a lot of trouble in the Marines and getting all my rank taken away a couple of times, to where I was a private for my first 3 years with no rank, right? I just lost it every year. And so what I learned from that experience is that I didn't have any rank, so I still needed to get things done. I still needed to get my job done. I still needed to work well with others. But I found that you don't need rank in order to work with anybody. You just need to find an in, and you need to find a common ground, and you need to find a mutual respect that you could line up shoulder to shoulder with anybody and basically, get work, like complete a mission or complete a task or complete anything. And so I think that was one of the biggest lessons that I took away from my military, because, I often say now, like, I wish like I had no rank and no title in the company and no nothing, that it was just anonymous, because I want to throw that off a cliff and work without it. I want to operate without that, and just be in the trench with everybody, like working through whatever needs to get worked through. I'm not on a pedestal just because I have a certain title. And so I think that's kind of, the word meritocracy or merit-based was a big, like, principle within special operations, where when we went to Marine Raider training, for the first like 11 months, nobody had any rank on their collar, even the officers, because the premise was that you need to be able to earn respect without your rank and get things done. And so basically they took it off of us, and we were all general population with each other for 11 months. And so it was really powerful.
Yeah, Prime, tell me a little bit about what you learned about your personal power and your personal influence without ranking, right? Because if you don't have that ranking on your, uniform, you then have to start, I would imagine, tapping into your own personal power and your own ability to influence and communicate and figure out positive ways to connect, create allyship and collaboration. So I'm sure there was, okay, I don't have a ranking, so now I have to figure out what my personal power and my personal influence is to help recruit the support, the help, and the hands that I need to drive forward tasks and or missions. So what did you learn about your personal power and your own individual influence in that space without ranking?
For personal power, I think at the time it was more of having awareness of what my biggest barrier was. So for me at the time, and even now, it was alcohol. So I went on from there. That was when I decided to stop drinking. And it was after the last time I got in trouble, my first couple years in. And it was like, I had a bad situation at home in Texas where my stepmom got killed in a car accident. And I was supposed to go home for the funeral, and I had a bad leader that basically did like pretended like I was going to get to go for the funeral. And then at the last minute, I even had a flight, I had my bags, they were taking me to the airport. And he's like, "Hey, we're pulling you because we need you for training this afternoon, so you're not going to be able to go." So that whole kind of mind twist that they put me through, it flipped a switch in my consciousness, to where I started having blackouts when I would drink, and I would basically revolt against authority within the Marine Corps, and I would, flip out on people that were higher rank and do all that stuff. But it would only be when I was drinking that I would lose control. And so I was like, okay, from my personal power standpoint, if I can control this, now I'm in control. So I'm taking drinking out of the equation. And so, that was the first step of finding my power, is removing the barrier, basically stepping into my power. And then on the influence side, I had no idea how to do that at that time. But what I figured out is that I was like, "Hey, I'm not allowed to go anywhere because I'm on restriction. Not allowed to do any go out of base. I'm not allowed." I was in Okinawa at the time for a year on my first deployment. We were going to other countries to train, but then we would come back, and the whole time I was on restriction for a year. So what I could do is I could go to the gym. And that was like my liberty or my freedom that I had outside of all the extra punishments that they would give me to clean stuff or do whatever it is, after hours. So when I would go to the gym, I noticed that, I would go to the gym, I would be at the pull-up bars outside of the barracks or the building that we lived. I would always be doing something to better myself, or hit a breakthrough, a plateau of something, hit the next level, hit the next level. And so I think that it, you know, after months, I started noticing that people gave me started giving me a lot of respect, because it's almost hard to deny someone. I call it street justice, but it's like hard to deny someone, you know, that's like outworking everyone around you, whatever their rank is or not, right? And so I think that that was the first step. And then whenever we got back to Camp Pendleton, you know, we do a lot of hikes in the infantry where we're hiking the mountains of Camp Pendleton with the heavy pack and all these big weapons and all that stuff. And so every time we would have people falling back and falling out of those hikes where they couldn't carry the pack or the weapon or whatever. And so I started having a mindset of like, I want to take as many packs as I can and weapons and pushing people up the hill. So I,
Wow.
you know, with no rank, I would have multiple packs, multiple weapon systems, dragging someone, pushing someone. And then once we got done off the hike, we would get back and everybody would be like, you know, cramped out and like done. Is this usually on Fridays that we do the hikes? So then after that, it's the weekend. Nobody's doing anything. They're just like, you know, recovering and rehab. I would get straight from the hike, and while everyone's there, they would see me change and I would go to the gym to do my workout, right? And so it's like people started noticing that type of thing, right? Where they're like, hey, and they found out that I had a trainer in La Jolla in San Diego, a mental focus trainer, that I was sometimes doing like 10-hour long training days on my own, right? And I was getting paid by the trainer to do that. So I was also making more money than most of the Marines that I was working with, even though I had no rank. And so this, some of these things started to get out. And then, you know, people were more, I started getting influence even with no rank, you know. And so I think that that really was a big lesson for me, because then I got promoted that next year. I started getting promoted meritoriously, which is like outside of regular promotion. Like you're so like you're doing so much that we have to recognize you, right? And so it was like boom, I got promoted to private first class, and then I got the next rank, and then I got the next rank. So I got to catch up with all my peers that had been ahead of me in rank the whole time, and then I got to kind of catch up. And so the thing I attribute the most to it is, as weird as it sounds, is just training, working out, and bettering myself, and eating clean, and you know, pushing myself to the next level and the next level, and figuring out, okay, well, I did, you know, 20 pull-ups. Now I would do 25. Now I'm doing 30. How do I do more? Do I wear a weighted vest with ankle weights when I'm on the pull-up bar now? And that's the kind of things that I was doing. And then, yeah, it seemed like I was stacking chips with everybody at a certain point, to where it was like, you know, I started getting a lot more respect, you know? And so that was a big learning lesson, is work ethic and effort.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting is the physical, the choice to physically stop drinking, right? But I'm curious of what was the mental shift to start investing in yourself that way? What was maybe the narrative shift? You know, and maybe you've already communicated that in regards to I'm out of control and I don't have control. When I'm drinking and when I'm not drinking, I now have control to invest in certain things. But was there a certain mental shift or a different narrative? I would imagine there was something that, you know, kind of kept you in that discipline that you were starting to develop and become stronger and stronger, both externally with all of the investment in fitness, but also internally in building that strength. Was there a mental shift or a perspective that you were holding that wasn't present prior?
Yeah, there was a shift, and it was when, because at a certain point when I was on my first deployment, I got in trouble for my last time, and they put me on admin separation, like they were kicking me out of the Marines. So it was like on my first deployment, how embarrassing is that, that I'm getting kicked out? And so while I was in that process, I contacted my grandmother back in Texas, and I let her know what was going on, and she was like, you know, basically, you can change your life. You know, you can change this right now. And like, she's all big into the law of attraction. But she was like, you can attract everything right now into your life. And she was coaching me and telling me, like, if it's rent houses that you want, because they're a construction company, so they have a lot of rent houses. If it's that, like, this is how you get that. Like, teaching me about writing checks to myself, right? And so during that time, she had me write a check to myself, and it was for 50,000, right? And at the time, I'm on restriction. I have, like, a couple $100 probably, or whatever it is. I'm not making a lot of money because all my pay is taken because of restriction. And so I'm thinking, I'm writing a $50,000 check to myself. Doesn't make sense, but I'm believing in it in the way that my grandmother's telling me. But it's crazy because everything that I did at that point, it all came true. So, like, the next deployment, I was in Iraq. And at the end of Iraq deployment, I had just reenlisted. And when I got back, I had like 60 grand in my account. And it's like, it came full circle within like a year and a half. So that was a big shift for me. And also seeing those results, it helped me really keep shifting and keep leaning into it. And like, there's no turning back, because everything was lighting up for me this way and everything was dark behind me.
Yeah, the momentum was in full motion, and the empowerment, and the investment your grandmother had in you, and the belief and the trust that she had in you, sound very powerful in that shift. And then it took a small amount of momentum to have it build and build and build to you driving forward in creating that strengthen your personal power and your influence. And I think even, what is it to have a teammate throw your pack on when you are struggling to get up a hill and push people up? I mean, that is just building rapport at the highest level. That is trade-offs on the highest level. That's kind of filling the piggy bank full of stock for when the day you're struggling, you got someone to have your back. Yeah, I just think about that, and that in itself would be enough to start influencing men around you, men and women around you.
Right. Yeah. And like, building chip stack is kind of the way that I think of it. But it's just like at special operations training, you never know. Like, you got to help everybody around you, because you never know when you're going to be running off the bus and one of your fin is going to fall off your backpack, or one of the essential items that you need is going to fall off. You're not going to notice it. It needs to be someone behind you. If you're not helping those guys, why would they help you? So it's a creating that mutually symbiotic relationships and those win-win, it's a buddy system, but it's a buddy system with everybody. Everyone's your buddy.
What has your time in the military taught you about peak performance and accessing flow, both individually and as a part of a team?
For peak performance, I was kind of always fascinated with the concept of different frameworks. Right. So, like, fighter pilots, they use the OODA loop, which is observe, orient, decide, act. And it's a turnkey loop system that they can do in 1 second and then reorientate themselves and do another loop and do another loop. So my point at, like, where I got really fascinated was when I was in Afghanistan. I was we lived in an enemy village for 7 months. And at our compound, we had a big camera system. So it's not like it was a secret where we were. So we got attacked every single day, almost. And so it would be like, whether you were, whether we were on a mission and all of a sudden we got attacked, or we were inside of our compound and we got attacked, we would need to go from being like, just going through your day on autopilot or going through a thing, to like, now it's like, boom, now we need to really like unlock performance fast. And like, and how do we do that? And so this is how we came up with the free operating system. And this is what the training that we use at Deepin Fitness, which stands for focus, relaxation, economy of motion, flow versus drag, and efficient breathing. But what I noticed is that always, whenever like chaos would break loose in Afghanistan, for example, and we would get attacked, it would be like the first instinct is to move and do whatever it is that you think is most important first. But what I learned over time is that the most important thing under chaos is finding some cover or get behind a wall where you're protected for a second. Take that deep breath and then prioritize your thoughts of what's most important and what's important now and what really needs to happen first, you know, and what is the most optimal way to do that. Because if you just react and you run out to go grab your buddy that just got shot, well, now you just got shot. And it's like, okay, so, you know, it takes that extra second to take the breath to then do that. So even though efficient breathing is the last part of free with focus, relaxation, economy of motion, efficient breathing, breathing is usually the first step that we do to like control our mind. So like breathing patterns and breathing intentionally can be like a remote control to control the mind. And that's like the biggest thing that I took away from performance and unlocking it in the military is that a lot of it is through controlling your mind is through your breath. And so those two things are superpowers. And oftentimes we're not putting any focus on our breath because it's something that happens our whole life, just like blinking. And so we don't need to put any focus and we'll still survive. But that when we do put the focus and we work through the breath, that we can really have that top-down cognitive control to where we can control our mind on like a higher level.
What I'm curious of is, as you are teaching and sharing this work and this step-by-step process that you used living in an enemy's village and getting attacked every day, and what is it actually, instead of dropping into fight or flight immediately and being in motion and running away or running towards or making that kind of quick decision to take cover and then deploy those steps, right? I'm curious of in the arenas and areas in which you're working, and you're starting to lead and empower people in, you know, whether it was combat zones or underwater arenas or, you know, executive boardrooms. What are you finding in all of these spaces the human default to move right away under pressure or to freeze? Because I imagine, as you're saying, your default was to maybe go and grab, you know, the guy who just got shot. Now I'm, you know, and I'm sure that the other default would be to freeze and not move and not to n take that next step. So while you're in these different spaces working with either corporate or athletes or military, are you finding a default, a freeze or a default to move quickly quite often, where this is really needing to be implemented and learned and practiced to then have in the everyday experience?
So fight or flight. Are we seeing more fight or more flight? And I think that from my experience, it's approach versus avoid in a lot of ways too, with the coping mechanisms that people have. But if someone, like for example, people starting and it's their first deep in fitness session, or it's their first elite training, or it's their first anything, I think one, they're more reserved and they're more hesitant and they're more kind of leaning towards the flight, right? Unless they're conditioned to approach their problems and to, so like, you know, I'm not an ice bath, big ice bath person like a lot of people right now, but like that's a great example of like anytime I get into the ice bath, I don't want to. I've already been freezing in the military and all these different things. And so it's like, okay, but every time I do, I'm overriding that limbic system that says, no, you're not in charge. I'm in charge. I'm telling you that you're getting in there, right? And so I think that the amount of exposure that you have in different disciplines like that allows you to override that part of your brain that wants to flight and you can fight more. I also see more, like we did a research study with Deep In Fitness a couple years back that basically one of the biggest takeaways was that this type of training and the underwater training and going for longer exposure and duration, what it does is it trains us to be more approach versus avoid with our coping. So like, approach-based coping, avoidance-based coping was like a lot of what I was doing when I was drinking. Because it was like, hey, all this drama that we've got in the Marines and all this, the off like our leadership that we don't like, let's just forget about all that and go drink, right? Or like, a lot of I see people today, they're just like they had a hard day at work or a long week, and they're like, hey, let's forget that and let's just go, party and whatever else. And it's avoidance. It's approach versus avoid because, unfortunately, when we avoid our problems, they don't go away. They just stack up, and usually they're stacking in our conscious and subconscious mind to where we start creating mountains out of molehills. And it's like this creates this huge thing that we're avoiding. But if we were just to face it and like stare it in the face, a lot of times it would just fall like a house of cards. It's like, what? What now? And so I think it's really healthy for all of us, whether it not, it doesn't have to be underwater training. Martial arts is another example of that type of thing where you can put yourself and adapt yourself because humans are the most adaptable beings on the planet. So we can adapt to anything, crawl, walk, run. If we expose ourselves to it, we can adapt to it. So I think it's a little bit, I don't see a lot of fight or flight, a lot of flight, to be honest. But I think more so at the beginning, if at all, and then it gets more into like, okay, let's lean in and what's next? What's next?
You've authored a book called Unlocking Flow. And I'm so curious to learn more about how you define flow and why is it such a powerful state for leaders and performers?
Yeah, it's my experience with flow comes from because I was a water survival instructor in the Marines, 15 plus years ago, and I had so many thousands of Marines that I trained that even back then, without me being like fully aware of it, I was getting so much like pattern recognition and understanding about, what unlocks or what drag how drag shows up and then kind of what flow is and opposite of that. So the two biomechanics of swimming is increased propulsion, which is flow, and reduced friction with which is drag. So out of so many thousands of people, and we've put close to 20,000 through Deep End Fitness since we started, but like all the Marines that I train, all of the athletes that I've worked with since getting out, like you can imagine like working on streamlining their body position and like creating, removing drag, right? Removing drag from like, oh, hey, when you were in your glide position, your legs came apart. And so that created what? Drag. So let's keep the, let's keep everything streamlined and that creates flow, right? Removing drag, adding flow. So after thousands and thousands of trainings and sessions, like it's evolved a lot. To where it's like, hey, we're only in the pool for a couple hours a week, but like especially we're training, these UFC fighters, Olympians, people that have really big competitions and things on their plate that they're preparing for, that we're training for, but we're only working with them like 2 to 3 hours a week, and they're saying that this is one of the most profound things that they're doing. Why is that? Well, because what they're saying is that it's not what just what we do at the pool, but it's how it translates outside of the pool, right? And so mental focus, closing out all the tabs and all the extra noise so we could be singularly focused on whatever it is that we're doing, right? When we're underwater, it's like a we think we're it's our mind tells us we're in a life and death situation. So that's like a good like anti-anxiety to actually close out the extra things that aren't real or that you don't need to be worried about because it helps you kind of dial back into like what's important, which is staying alive, my breath, and working through this situation, and then I can move on to the next thing. So the mental focus, closing out the tabs, like that's been a huge one. The relaxation, we say on-demand relaxation because when you get underwater, we all have a tendency to tense after being down there for a little bit. So we have to give ourselves permission again to relax and then to relax. And so it's like, think of it like low power mode on your cell phone. when you're like at a concert or somewhere where you're like need to go into low power mode. Same thing when we go underwater, we do not want to be burning any extra energy doing anything. So we want to put ourselves into low power mode, and that's that extreme relaxation. And then economy of motion, flow versus drag. So we talked about the physical drag, but then there's also mental drag. And so a lot of times what's going through someone's head, you know, if it's their first time in the deep end fitness session or something, they're thinking, well, I was never good at swimming, or, you know, I messed up when I was in the military and I didn't pass dive school, or like whatever it is, like all these stories that we attach ourselves to, right? And so it's like letting go of that, letting go of the mental drag, right? Letting it, all of that. And first off, it's being aware of it, noticing it. And then we can start to work with it and partner with our mind instead of working against it. But the mind is a survival mechanism that's always trying to keep us alive and assign meaning to everything, right? So if we can identify that and have more awareness, then we could start to partner with our mind and work with it instead of resist it or working against it and resisting. And then the last one, efficient breathing. So we do really minimalist breathing protocols before we get in the water, and then we regulate our breathing throughout the entire session. So we have different tools, and we use the gears of breath as well, which is another like breathing format to help us regulate. But we typically do an upper regulation before getting in the water. So we will charge up and turn the engine on and warm our breathing all the way up, and then we will cool down. And once we're cool, then we start the workout. So, and then we regulate throughout. So, simple kind of flow for focused relaxation, economy of motion, efficient breathing.
I think what's interesting is you're talking about the mental drag, and I'm oftentimes sharing with clients, you know, of the practice of focusing on what is within our control versus what is outside of our control, because our time and our energy and focus is probably one of the most important real estates that we have. And you know, when you really start bringing that awareness in and recognizing what is outside of your control, and then you think about how much time, energy, and focus that you're putting towards something that no matter how angry or sad or frustrated or how much you will it to change, it probably won't change. And so, what happens when we are kind of porous or leaky with our energy in places that truly should not be receiving that energy, time, or focus. And so I see that really in alignment with that mental drag, or, you know, whether you're recognizing or not, being kind of wasteful with that time, energy, and focus. And I love the vision of the physical flow, and then you have the mental flow, and then setting your nervous system using breath up for success. So it's this, I'm hearing a little bit, it's a combination of the right amount of like pressure or challenge with the ability of letting go and relaxing and being one. And in this case, it's water. So you're being one with the elements. There's something that I'm curious if you've had experience or have taught around this, but what role does healing play in physical, emotional, and mental healing play in someone being able to access flow? What role does healing play in accessing flow?
I think it plays a huge role. You know, there's a couple terms that I are like ingrained in me, and one of them is breakdown equals breakthrough. But I feel like, you know, we all get stuck and we all break down and we all have failures. We all have losses, you know, that then we have the option to keep it a loss or we can turn it into a win, right? And when we turn it into a win, or we reframe something, or we shift and reframe, that then we can add flow, and we can find the flow from, like, we can find the breakthrough from the breakdown that we had. But the, you know, the healing work is nothing but flow from my standpoint. And some of it is challenging where you're moving through resistance, so it feels a little bit like you're in drag a little bit, but then it opens up and you're in flow. I think that there's, we talked about the physical and the mental, but I think that flow is also emotional flow. I think it's spiritual flow. I think it's, even psychological, or, there's like all these different lenses and aspects of it. But that, we're taking care of ourselves, right? As like just as an athlete or as an executive or as a military athlete or whatever it is, we're taking care of ourselves. And people say, we always focus on the physical first. So we got to get into shape. We got to hit all of our times. We got to meet the standard. But then once you get physically, at least meeting the standard, then what's next? And they always say, like, once you have your physical, everything's 90% mental or more. But it's like, okay, well now, like, once I get my thoughts cleaned up, I got my nervous system in check and I got my body working. Okay, well, what's next for me? Well, what emotions are driving your actions, right? And it's like the emotional, the EQ, like not just with myself, but with others. Like there's emotional growth. And then, okay, well, now I'm starting to work on all my emotional stuff, and I got my circle and I got my relationships working better. So what's next? And it's like, well, it's spiritual. Like I got to work on my spiritual health. I got to tap back in to my relationship with myself and nature and the world and higher power and everything, to where, I'm basically I'm pouring into my own cup in that way. And so I think that like our culture doesn't talk about that a lot, because everything's so about what does this person look like, right? But it's like, yeah, and even if you look great, there's a lot of things that, we can evolve, and we can, really break through individually and collectively.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear you speak about these kind of levels and degrees of kind of arriving, whether it's you're physically in place, you're mentally in place, and you're talking about like kind of hitting these standards in these different buckets, and as you do so, you become more expansive in what your awareness is and your intuition even and your accessibility to things, right? Because otherwise you're kind of under the rubble of, the mental mess or the physical mess or whatever it is. And so there's this, as you speak about it, I kind of like there's levels to like freedom almost, to this expansiveness, to this ability to go from only being able to like have that vision and focus on yourself to then you start kind of lifting your head. And now I have the vision and focus with the person right across from me. And then, okay, now I'm actually feeling the whole. I can actually have that vision and connection with the entire team. And then the spirituality is like, okay, now I feel like I'm one with nature. I'm in tune with all the elements around me. And that's earned, is what I'm hearing. It comes from a place of experiencing health and healing and discipline and putting that right amount of challenge and pressure on self and letting go to accomplish kind of these buckets or each of these levels. I once had a coaching session and I was talking about self-care and rest and recovery and what is it to have an element of balance in the grind. And, the response was, if you're not always kind of going for it, how do you actually get better? And here I am as an executive coach. I'm a three-time Olympian. I know what it takes to really grind to get to where you're looking to go. But also as an athlete, I have a really deep understanding of rest and recovery. And one of the topics that you have focused on is managing stress, burnout, and performance fatigue in high performers. And I love to just kind of ask a little bit about your perspective and maybe some key practices or approach to managing this. And I would love for even just your perspective on my clients' comment on, well, if you're not always grinding, like how are you going to get better? How are you going to get there? And what is it to actually take your foot off the gas when you're looking to get to where you want to go? And what is the importance of that? Can you speak to the importance of when do you need to actually glide and when do you need to actually have the foot down on the pedal? What's coming up for you with this question?
So, first off, to follow up from something you said a couple minutes ago, we only have so much cognitive horsepower and bandwidth. So it's very important where we put our energy. I have a one of my good buddies, he's a professional surfer and my surf coach, Cole Hauschmann. And when he's training me to surf, he always tells me, stop focusing on like your feet or the board, because that's when you fall. Focus on where you want to go, because that's when you ride the wave, right? Focus on where you want to go. And on that is like a big takeaway for me. But to answer your question, my best example is I work with one of the top MLB athletes in the game for the last 4 or 5 years. And he's been having an amazing season this year, but I got to basically we went I think we went on a training trip in the Dominican in January. We came back and it seems like he went to spring training after that, which is always the case, but he's been in game after game after game, but he's having a really good season and he's trying to elevate his performance, but he never gets days off. And his adrenal fatigue is there because every day he's at a game with everybody yelling at him and all the bells and whistles and all the noises and the screens and the whole production, right? So what we've worked with him and what we found is that what's most important, since we don't have days off, is that once we're back in the locker room and then we're basically transitioning to being off that night, that we have a routine that we go through that's a specific breathing practice. But as we're doing that, we're letting our body and our mind know that we're done, that we're done for the day, that we can turn off all of our alertness and like our spidey senses and paying attention to every little thing, and we can start to recover. And recovery is key now. So it's like we're basically dimming our nervous system in order to do that. We're deactivating, we're calming down, we're deep breathing, and mostly it's on the exhale, right? Short breath in, long exhale, we're down regulating and deactivating. But really it's like whatever your process or ritual, like, I work with one of my teams that basically one of our marketing girls was telling me, like, hey, when I leave work, I'm so like mentally turned on. And then I go pick up my kids. And it's like, how do I turn off? And it's like, so we created like a little thing that she does when she gets into her car, where she's like basically clocking out and she's clocking into her family and relaxation and relationships and this and that. But I think that we need to have that like conscious moment with ourself. I'm working on doing a better job of this with myself too, so I could be more present with my kids. But it's like, yeah, at the end of our workday from being like so on, how can we relax and like basically decompress and shift into that recovery mode, and because it's really important. And then working with executives and athletes, I've found like a lot of the burnout is like adrenal fatigue, and it comes in all shapes and sizes, but the worst one that I've seen is like UFC fighters that basically they have a fight week before their fight where they have a lot of media and they have what I call theater arts, where they're being put like across from their opponent up close for a media opportunity, but what happens is their adrenaline lights up like they're actually fighting right then. And once, if their adrenaline's been blazing all week, they're not going to have any left over for the fight. And so I go back to like the lion in the middle of the field that just chills, you know, every hour of the whole week. And then for like 30 seconds, it goes and attacks. And then it gets all its food for the week. It just used all of its adrenaline in that short burst. And now it's back to rest and digest and relax, right? So I think when we're so turned on, like as a society, with like hustle and bustle and grind and work and what's next and this and that and checklists, that it's like we need to be do a better job of checking in with ourselves on that piece.
Yeah, we actually met at merging vets and players and sat in circle together. But one of the things that was interesting that I learned from that circle, or a comment that I heard, was we're trained as athletes or military, and probably this is true for corporate, we're trained to turn it on, but we're not trained to turn it off. And you exactly, and what you're speaking about are sharing and teaching individuals how to turn it off. If you're going to warm up for a game, if you're going to warm up for your day, if you're going to prepare yourself to go into battle, whatever your battle may be at whatever level, you also have to be disciplined enough to bring yourself down and train yourself to turn it off. And how important that is, especially in today's world, with how fast-paced it is and how accessible, and our electronics and the news and the social media, and how it all just, it can really suck you in. And even, whatever kind of space you're working in, if you're at a startup and it's moving 1,000 miles an hour, you're building, the Ferrari as it's flying down the freeway already. What is it actually to train yourself to turn it off? Or shut it off, or shut it down and cool down the system, because we're not all at the luxury where we can jump, on a plane and be at a week-long vacation every other month. And sometimes that's just the cost or the price or the sacrifice of the industry in which you're living. And I really love this practice of integrating something to turn it off. And you're using breath work in that, and that's massively important to be a part of that kind of cool down of the nervous system. I think I'm gonna finish our last question here, and I want to ask you, what is your greatest desire for human development? What is your greatest desire for your clients and your mission that you're embarking on in the world?
Well, as a collective, it's world peace. But as individuals, it's always breaking through potential and finding their potential in something, right? Like a lot of times when I do performance workshops, I'll show one of the largest mountains in the world, and I'll showcase it, and I'll set up the stage, and then I'll say, you know, basically, this is your whole life that you've been climbing this mountain, right? And it's 100,000 feet tall. So from 0 to 100%, where are you in relation to your potential, right? And so depending on what that is, and it's like, okay, well, if you think you've unlocked 30 or 40% of your potential in your life, what's it gonna take? What's the shift? What's the barrier that you're gonna address in order for you to get from here to up here? And know that as the higher we go, the less oxygen it is, right? The more difficulty the route is. So what changes are you willing to make in order to unlock that potential, right? What are you willing to throw off the side of the mountain in order to make it? Like, what are you willing to give up? What are you willing to add? What are you willing to put in? What type of effort are you willing to do to find your, because you're not going to reach your potential like just when you hit the very top. You're going to start reaching it along the route, like now, if you jump in, and it's the journey, not the destination, right? So, I think that For me, I never expected that I would be doing any of the stuff that I've done or that I'm working on now, and like all the media projects that we have, and like all the different stuff that is all around the singular focus is positive impact. But like I never would have expected. So there's been like I feel I've been very fortunate to have the right people at the right time in support to help me break through to find my potential. So I think that's my biggest goal and my biggest intent working with anyone, whether it's executive, athlete, military, that it, like, what's possible for you? You know, and that's one of my favorite things in the underwater training is like, oftentimes, like someone that holds your breath for a minute or more, or two or three or four, whatever it is, that they come out of the water and they're like, wow, I never thought I would ever be able to do X, Y, or Z. And it's like, okay, well, that's great. What else do you think you couldn't do? What's next? What's the next hilltop? Right. And so I love that. And yeah, I feel like we all have more in different areas, but we might need a change of perspective in order to unlock it, right? Or we might need someone, some guidance, or we might need, you know, a mantra or something, you know, I don't know. Like there's all different kinds of things that play into it. But yeah, that's my goal. And the mission when we started Deep in Fitness, it's still the same, create a positive shift in humanity. And we feel like, you know, when people are doing that, this type of training together, and we always start out with a circle of trust at the beginning and the end of every session. And so it's a very intentional, like tribal type community. Whether it's your first time or you've been there for years, like we're all connected and we all helping each other to find wins and to evolve and improve in different areas. And so, yeah, that's kind of my focus.
I love it. Tell our listeners what Deep End Fitness is. We've talked a lot about it. I think people are getting sprinkles of exactly, a little bit of what it is, but tell us exactly what it is and how we find you guys.
Yeah, so it's an underwater performance training community, and we started from being water survival instructors, me and my partner Don Tran, in the Marine Corps and in Marine Raiders, and then it's evolved. You know, over the last 8 years, it's evolved over. Within the first year, we were training, you know, NFL off-season groups and Olympians and UFC and MLB and NFL. And so we've gotten a lot of pattern recognition and learning from we learn from every single group that we train with, you know. And so the program's evolved a lot, but now we have 50 programs across the world, most of which that are in the US. And then we have one in UAE and Dubai, one in London in the UK, and then one in Sydney, Australia. So if anyone's listening to this that's in a key city next to a Deep End Fitness, you can reach out to me. My email is prime@utlnation.com, prime@utlnation.com. And that comes from the Underwater Torpedo League, which is the crazy sport that we run, that we have a tournament coming up in Austin next month. And Underwater Torpedo League's going on ESPN next year too.
No way. That's so awesome. That's so awesome. Prime, I'm so moved and motivated by the work that you're doing. I absolutely enjoyed your words. I thank you for your story, your personal story that you shared, amongst the wisdom and the knowledge and the practices that you provided us. I knew you would show up and you absolutely did. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. And I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And obviously with all of your experience, I was so excited to chat with you. But I would just also wanted to say, like, with everything that's going on in the world, it's a noisy place right now. And so as much as any of us can be the signal and not the noise, like that's what I think we all need to be you know, tapping into right now. So I appreciate you.
Be the signal, not the noise. Thanks, Prime.
If you
you enjoyed today's episode, please take the opportunity to share with a friend, follow Mindful Warrior Radio, and leave a review. To learn more about Mindful Warrior and Mindful Warrior Radio, please follow us on Instagram at The Real Mindful Warrior and check out our website at www.mindfulwarrior.com. I look forward to our next discussion here on Mindful Warrior Radio.